This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. This weekend, a church in Fayetteville will serve as the center point for Congo Awareness Week in Northwest Arkansas. Events over 6 days are designed to make people more aware of what's happening in the African nation. And what has been happening is horror and violence on a massive scale. A war involving soldiers from several nations that has resulted in the largest death toll by war since World War II. Estimates as high as 5.4 million deaths since 1998 due to violence, starvation, and illness caused by the war. Pappy Mutamousi, a student at the University of Arkansas and a member of First Christian Church of Fayetteville, is a native of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Sunday, he'll tell his story at the church.
Since the death of my mom on the street, my life on the street for 3 to 4 years on the street as homeless kid, and then my life in the orphanage, and then when I was rescued by the rebel working the mining, and then how I escape till I get here in the United States.
Pappy says his story, the death of his mother, living on the streets homeless for years, then being forced to work as a miner excavating the mineral coltan, is a similar story to millions of others by young people in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Pappy says he was eventually taken in by an orphanage, able to get a job at the U.S. Embassy in the Congo as a janitor, and then get to the U.S., first as a student at Coffeyville Community College in southeastern Kansas, and now as a business and finance major at the University of Arkansas. When he was moving from Kansas to Fayetteville to continue his studies, the pastor of his church in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, called First Christian Church in Fayetteville.
And he told us, I know this young man, he's moving to town, and I'm trying to link him up with somebody.
Cheryl Sybrand is the secretary at First Christian Church in Fayetteville.
From there, we met Poppy at the university one day, just had lunch, and I'm kind of nosy, so I asked him some questions, and he told us a little bit about his life, and then I immediately went home and just started doing research, and I realized, why have I not heard anything about the Congo at all?
And research into the Democratic Republic of Congo reveals that the nation, especially the eastern part of the country, has been ripped apart by war and mass rape. The conflict has been described as the African World War because of the high number of casualties and the number of different nations that have sent soldiers into the conflict. Last year, the First Christian Church in Fayetteville held its first Congo Awareness Week with a modest goal in mind.
Just establish awareness within our own church. We hope that anybody from the general public that might have read about it or have any interest at all would come and learn more as well. Mainly just to increase awareness to let people know that about the situation there, and that once you do know, then just as a justice issue, as if you care about humanity at all, that you need to pay attention and do what you can.
The second ever Congo Awareness Week, sponsored by the church, begins Sunday with Pappy telling his story twice at the 9 and 11 a.m. services. Monday night, a documentary about the large population of homeless children in Kinshasa, the capital, will be shown at 6:30 at the church, and the filmmaker, Gilbert Malamba, will be on hand to discuss the movie. A prayer vigil is scheduled for Tuesday night, and on Wednesday, a small effort designed to prove to people how almost all of us are connected to the violence in the Congo, what the church is calling a sellout, as in C-E-L-L, as in cell phones. Cell phones are involved because
because of the mineral coltan that's used to make so many of our electronics work is mined in the Congo and is related directly to the conflict. People are forced to work in the mines that happen to Poppy. Different militia groups can then use those funds to buy more arms, and it just kind of perpetuates. So we're just asking people for an hour during the day, during your lunch break, to turn off your cell phones, just in an act of solidarity.
About 80% of the world's coltan is pulled from mines in the Congo. The mineral is refined into a substance that can hold a high electrical charge and is used in almost every cell phone, remote control, MP3 player, and other digital convenience in the world. Last year's first Congo Awareness Week did seem to have an impact on members of the congregation, especially Allie Kirkpatrick and her husband Kirk.
I'm a mom here in Fayetteville, and my husband Kirk and I we have adopted a little girl in the Congo, and she's still there, and Kirk is traveling on Thursday to go pick her up and bring her home.
The Kirkpatricks began the adoption process last December, and Kirk will be back with their daughter in 2 to 6 weeks. Allie says she and Kirk had been discussing adoption for some time when last year's Congo Awareness Week began.
We had a traveling minister come and speak, and he was so passionate. And in his sermon, after he discussed what was going on in the Congo, he said, well, now that you know, what are you going to do? And adoption immediately came to my mind. It has been on the table for years with us. And we just felt that God called us to adopt a little girl from the Congo.
This year's edition of Congo Awareness Week also includes a Congolese meal and fundraiser at the church on Friday night, the 22nd, to help with the adoption, and concludes Saturday morning, the 23rd, with a walk with Congo women at Gully Park to support Women for Women International. Pappy Mutamasi says he hopes a week such as the one set to begin Sunday will not only raise awareness, but conversation.
People in the Congo mostly want somebody to talk about them. By letting your representative know, the senator know what is happening. And they should talk about, like, on the federal meeting, on the Congress, and the Senate, on the Washington, D.C. And then a United States with its power can say that something in the Congo.
There has been some legislative movement in Washington. This summer, the president signed into law the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act that includes some regulations for companies trading in the Congo's mineral resources like coltan and gold. Foreign policy observers seem to be in agreement that it is a first step, but much more needs to be done to stop the violence and mass rapes in the country. Cheryl Seibert, the secretary at First Christian Church in Fayetteville, says she hopes awareness weeks like the one beginning Sunday can help make a difference.
I was thinking, too, about one of the presentations that we did at church after we attended a Congo symposium in Indianapolis. I guess I was just so in awe of what a beautiful country the Congo is as well, just with the landscape and the waterfalls and the rivers and mountains and just the potential that's there for people to someday be able to go there and enjoy. And that's my hope, that someday there will be peace, and it may not come in Poppy's time or my time or Allie's, but maybe Janie or my children, or when Poppy has children, well, they'll get to see it and we can say, hey, we helped. You know, you can look at South Africa and so many other countries that, you know, 50 years ago people were talking, you know, the same as we are now about the Congo. And it just takes time. We just got to be part of getting the ball rolling towards more positive.
The second ever Congo Awareness Week begins Sunday morning at First Christian Church at 220 North College in Fayetteville and continues through the Walk for Congo Women at Gully Park Saturday the 23rd from 8:30 until 11 a.m. You can learn more at congoweek.org and find more links for information about the Congo at ozarksatlarge.com. This is Ozarks at Large. Mortgage crisis-driven home foreclosures are in the news once again, and we've heard the reports about certain families that abandon their pets as they vacate their homes, swamping local animal shelters. Arkansas's wildlife shelters have had to weather hard economic times as well. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has this report on how they've fared during the recession.
Tender Heart Wildlife Rehabilitation on Bunch Springs Road in Berryville in Carroll County is operated by Andrea White. It's located in one of those pretty forested neighborhoods common in rural communities. The carport is neatly stacked with crates, food supplies, and cages. One contains a possum buried in quilts this chill weekday morning.
This is Angus, and Angus is a full-grown possum. Pretty sad story on this guy. Somebody found him and they kept him for the winter, but they did not provide him with enough warmth, and so his ears were frostbitten off.
A herd of papillon patrol the place and lead the way into the refuge. Three full-grown deer appear out of nowhere, followed by a fat white rabbit.
This here with the horns, this is Amos, and he is losing his eyesight quite rapidly. thinking that possibly in the next 3 or 4 years he may be blind. This is Newbie. She's got arthritis real bad from been having hit by a car. Don't see Bambino. Bambino's my three-legged deer. And he's hiding somewhere and won't come out because you're here.
As she hands out treats, Andrea explains why these guys are permanent residents. She pays the vet bills from donations when she has them or out of pocket. Her husband works at a local publishing house, so helps to support the family. And Andrea worked as a home health care nurse for 15 years, but retired to dedicate herself full-time to the center. She accepts all native species except coyote, fox, or skunk because of rabies risk. She can't afford to inoculate everyone. She also takes in ferrets. Space is really limited here, so Andrea transfers most animals to other rehabilitators, which is the practice. The closest was Witter Wildlife Refuge in Madison County, which could accommodate even predators like wolves, but it went into foreclosure. One other wildlife rehabilitator went under, she said. So now she has to transport animals all the way to a center in MENA. Things are quiet now, but springtime was way hectic.
I think we took in $7,000 this year in donations, and we've shelled out over $11,000. And it got so bad this year that we ended up having to shut our doors in August and just basically call people who have donated in the past and say, hey, can you help us get out of this crunch so that we can open up for the fall babies? And people really came through for us this year, and we managed to open up in 3 weeks. So, but we are still, you know, we didn't get ahead. We got back to the zero point.
Tenderheart's a registered nonprofit and is part of a network of individual wildlife rehabilitator volunteers around the state. Permitted by the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission, they take in sick, injured, or orphaned animals and rehabilitate them for release back to where they were found. Blake Sassy at Arkansas Game and Fish oversees the program. He's a non-game mammal coordinator. He's in charge of everything from shrews to bats, as well as coyotes, beaver, and wild hogs.
The Game and Fish Commission started issuing permits for wildlife rehabilitation back in 2003. Up until then, no permit was required to work with Arkansas Wildlife, although a permit from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was necessary to rehabilitate birds.
67 rehabilitators operate around the state currently. Sassy doesn't keep track, but says the recession didn't seem to have much of an impact.
Last year, we had more new rehabilitators than we have actually twice as many new rehabilitators as we've had in any other year since we started the program.
He said 11 new ones were permitted last year. And to become an operator, you must follow some strict rules.
People wanting to become wildlife rehabilitators have to serve some time as an apprentice rehabilitator, working under the guidance of an experienced person that gives them advice on, you know, how to care for the animals. And they have to accumulate 200 hours of training or experience before they can become a full-fledged wildlife rehabilitator.
And all must have an associate veterinarian working with them to provide advice or medical care. Rehabilitators must file reports, but Arkansas Game and Fish does not inspect or oversee operators.
Well, we have on occasion, you know, put out press releases talking about wildlife rehabilitation and the need for more rehabilitators. We generally don't provide the training ourselves, although we participate. There are a couple of wildlife rehabilitation organizations in the country, and they sometimes hold training classes here in the state.
Specifically, the National Wildlife Rehabilitators Association and the International Wildlife Rehabilitation Council. And although Arkansas Game and Fish's annual budget averages close to $90 million, it does not provide any funding to volunteer rehabilitators.
Most of these folks are individuals, and they pay for it out of their own funds. They can't charge people for taking animals to be rehabilitated, but they're able to receive donations if someone wants to give them to them.
One of the longest surviving rehabilitators in the state is Lynn Scambato. She's director of Morningstar Wildlife Rehabilitation Center near Gravette in Benton County. She says getting state funding would be good and bad.
It would be wonderful to have some monetary help. On the other hand, and this was discussed many, many years ago, was the fact that how do you judge when somebody says, I need this and that and the other?
The required oversight by Arkansas Game and Fish Commission might also be problematic, she said. She's been in operation for 23 years now, and is one of a few sanctioned taken raptors.
In order to do birds, you have to have a federal permit.
And huge cages within which raptors like eagles and vultures and hawks can fly to exercise their growing or injured wings so they can be released. Morningstar is also a nonprofit, has a devoted group of funders, and those who bring animals tend to donate.
One of the things that helps me raise money is that I do also have an educational permit, and so I do programs with my birds, birds of prey. Because of that, I don't charge for those programs, but because of that, it tends to generate donations.
Terry Gregory is a full-time special ed school teacher in Augusta on the Arkansas Delta, but in her spare time, she takes in wildlife. She's permitted by both Arkansas Game and Fish and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She lives with her husband, Bill, along the White River in Woodruff County.
I've been doing this since 1974. Take in all native wildlife. We can't take in bears, so I have not raised any bears, but I have raised many raccoons. I've raised 7 this year. I had 11 last year that I raised and put back in the wild, put 2 bobcats back in the wild. With my federal license, I can raise baby owls and hawks.
She's also rehabbed coyotes. Terry has sub-permitted help during busy times and often brings babies with her to school, which the children love to observe. Searcy Animal Clinic helps with medical emergencies. She says she knows of other volunteers who've had to close for a while due to the recession. She doesn't take donations. She says she's self-sustaining.
In our world, God's given us so much that we just have to give back, and this is the way my family and I have chosen, just one of the ways that we choose to give back.
In return, she says, some of the critters come back to say thank you, and of course to beg for a free handout.
Oh yeah, I've had lots of raccoons that would come back, and you could see that they've had their own babies, and they still allow me to pick them up, and they know who I am, and I know who they are. You know, they say, well, how do you tell the difference? Well, it's just like every child, every raccoon looks different to me. They have different personalities, and I still have one coyote who comes down the river and comes home.
Plus, she has a gang of released raccoons that live out back in the trees, she says. Back at Tenderheart Wildlife Center in Berryville, Andrea White feeds a chipmunk some treats in his cage in the laundry room. Every spring, cages line the living room, carport, and anywhere else she can fit them. Last year, she rehabilitated over 200 animals.
Hey, this is Han Solo, and Han Solo is a chipmunk. So a cat just basically ate him alive, and how he survived is beyond me. I mean, by the grace of God.
And how these wildlife rehabilitators have survived in this really tough economic time is also remarkable. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
To learn more about becoming a certified wildlife rehabilitator, you can find a link at ozarksatlarge.com. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. The University of Arkansas is working toward a more sustainable campus. This week, we have a series of reports on those efforts. Today, Ozarks at Large's Ithi Igniehotri-Madulker has this profile of one of the people working on a more sustainable U of A.
Sustainability may mean a lot of things to a lot of people, but to Lauren Scott Turley, it is a matter of personal beliefs and choices.
To me, I think at the end of the day, it's kind of paying it forward. Is what should we be doing today to be sure that the generations that follow us have a safe environment to grow up in and live their lives? So to me, it's kind of a personal thing. Is we owe it to the people that are going to come after us, leaving as to the best we can, leaving it a better place than kind of when we found it. So.
As the Director of Utilities Operations and Maintenance for University of Arkansas, Scott says efforts are already being made to make the campus energy efficient and hence sustainable. For instance, the university is currently in the process of wrapping up an energy services performance contract.
This is a contractor who specializes in energy conservation technology, focusing on water conservation projects, low-flow toilets, low-flow showers and housing, lighting technologies, and then the last will be some modifications to the HVAC systems, the heating and cooling systems on campus, primarily doing two things. One is scheduling temperature settings in those rooms so that during hours when folks are not in the buildings, the thermostats will set back to either higher or lower depending on the time of year. And the other is occupancy sensors. So if I'm not in my office for some number of minutes, the system will know that, and then it'll either turn the lights out and maybe set the thermostat up or down, to, again, depending on time of year.
Scott says a number of progressive measures have been taken within the utility system too. A large heat pump has been installed to move energy from one place to another with 100% efficiency. Another effort has been the installation of 6 new modular boilers in addition to the large boilers that were installed in 1974.
2 years ago, we completed a project that put in 6 small modular boilers. So we use steam to heat the campus. And so these small boilers are much faster to react, so they can turn on and off a lot more quickly than the old style boilers. So we can match our heating load much better. So that saves energy, and they're just more efficient than the older boilers that we had.
According to Scott, an important concern is improving the energy efficiency of the older buildings on campus. The structures are wasteful of energy due to a number of factors.
Certainly just the age of the buildings on campus. They're very sound buildings, very well-built buildings, but just the technologies have progressed substantially since then. The ability to control the temperature and the systems in the buildings. A lot of those older buildings, they either heated or cooled. They wouldn't do both at the same time. And they weren't very good at switching back and forth. Window technology is something that's come just light years since, even in the last few decades, of being able to build windows that are very energy efficient. And so older buildings typically didn't have that.
The chemistry building, built in 1926, was recently renovated using new temperature control and window technologies. Next on the list are Vole Walker and Ozark Halls. The university now requires all major renovation projects, as well as new constructions, to be LEAD, that is, LEED certified.
LEED is part of the USGBC, the United States Green Building Council, and it's a rating system that talks about how green, how energy efficient, sustainable a building project can be. And so you get points for various things: water conservation, energy conservation, how you dispose of and use construction materials when you build the building. So it covers a lot of different things. And the university actually, about 6 years ago, adopted that as LEED certified as kind of our basic building design, which is, I think, another statement on the behalf of the university that we're committed, to doing the right thing, and both from a cost-conscious standpoint as well as energy and sustainability.
The university spends about $12 million annually on utilities. 40% of that budget is spent on natural gas to heat the campus. Another 40% is spent on electricity for lighting and air conditioning, and the rest is spent on water and sewer. Scott explains that the use of new technologies in renovating or constructing buildings has a major impact on the university's savings.
Implementation of all of these projects is expected to cut our energy consumption by about a third. So it's a very major major impact. The way a performance contract works is you finance those improvements with the money you save on the utility. So it's a way that we can do a lot of good things for the campus, but it doesn't really take any more operating funds or capital funds that we would have otherwise been spending anyway, so it's kind of a win-win situation.
However, a number of electrical devices consume energy even when they're not being used.
I heard a statistic that the kind of average student that comes to campus now has 15 things with them that plug in. And most of those things, whether they're on or not, are consuming electricity if they're plugged in. And so one of the things that's easy to do is to try and put as many of those things like on a power strip as you can, so that if you leave for the day and you're not using the charger or whatever, you can kind of turn them all off.
Scott says students, staff, and faculty can also help save energy in several ways, such as switching the lights off when leaving office or class and having patience while utilities management establishes fixed schedules to heat and cool campus buildings. With support from the university community, the UFA hopes to cut down its energy consumption by a third. There are other goals, too, that the university has in mind.
The campus has committed itself to a goal of carbon neutrality, and that's all in, as part of the campus sustainability effort. And so certainly the utility operation that I work with has a major part in that. It's a big challenge. We use a lot of electricity, and most of our electricity here on campus comes from coal, which we really don't have control over. And so from a carbon footprint perspective, that's going to be a tough hill to climb. But the first and best thing we can do is not use it in the first place. And so that's why I think the efforts we're making to reduce our energy consumption is really the first and best use of our efforts. So,
for Ozarks at Large, this is Iti Agnihotri Mudholkar.
Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, our series about University of Arkansas sustainability continues with a report about how cooking oil is fueling some changes on campus. That's tomorrow on Ozarks at Large.
Try not to get worried. Try not to turn on to problems that upset you. Well, don't you know everything's all right? Yes, everything.
Everything's All Right is a song from Jesus Christ Superstar, a rock opera by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice that opened on Broadway on this date in 1971. Lloyd Webber is a British composer who was born on March 22, 1948 in London. He studied at Oxford and at the Royal College of Music. His first collaboration with lyricist Tim Rice was Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat in 1968. It was followed by the rock opera Jesus Christ Superstar in 1971, which blended classical forms with rock music. The production won 5 Tony Awards in 1972. Their last major collaboration was Evita in 1978. Lloyd Webber's eclectic rock-based works helped revitalize musical theater. In both London and New York City, his 1981 musical Cats, based on poems by T.S. Eliot, became the longest-running musical in history. He later collaborated on Starlight Express, The Phantom of the Opera, and Sunset Boulevard, among other stage works. In 2006, The Phantom of the Opera surpassed Cats to become the longest-running show on Broadway. Lloyd Webber was knighted in 1992 and ennobled in 1997. Training officially began at Walnut Ridge Army Flying School with students training on the BT-13 on this date in 1942. In late September, the Southeast Training Command had clarified confusion over whether the site would become a glider school by announcing that 20 cadets from Camden and 102 cadets and 3 student officers from Decatur, Alabama, would be sent to Walnut Ridge for basic flight training, and the glider program was to be established at Stuttgart. In less than 2 years, 5,310 students entered training, and 4,641 graduated. 42 students and instructors died in training. Elmer Sperry, the American inventor best known for perfecting the use of gyroscopes, was born on this date in 1860. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
It's Tuesday, the 12th of October, 2010. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me on the phone is Becca Bacon-Martin, the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers. Hello, Becca.
Hey, Kyle. Well, we've got to start with the obvious. Chris Isaacs is in concert tonight at the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville, the pop singer best known for his hit Wicked Game. Showtime is 7 o'clock, and tickets start at $48. If you're in the River Valley, the University of Arkansas at Fort Smith Chorale is in concert at 7:30 at the Arkansas Best Performing Arts Center, and tickets for that are $6.
And some people, you know, may know Chris Isaac more from his Showtime series when he played himself.
Right. I don't know a thing about Chris Isaac, I'll tell you honestly, but I know people who are very excited, so.
Should be a good show. Becca, thanks.
Thanks, Kyle.
Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers. Arkansas Supreme Court Justice Robert Brown has written a new book titled Defining Moments, Historic Decisions by Arkansas Governors from McMath through Huckabee. The book examines pivotal moments in the terms of the state's 10 post-war governors. This week, Roby Brock of TalkBusiness.net sat down with Justice Robert Brown to talk about the book.
Well, let's start with your inspiration for this book. What inspired you to write this? And tell me a little bit about how you researched all of it.
Well, I think the inspiration came from John F. Kennedy's, President John F. Kennedy's book, Profiles in Courage. And I've always had an immense respect for the Arkansas governors and the position. To my way of thinking, it's the hardest job in the state. I mean, what the governor has to deal with on a daily basis, prisons, education, Medicaid, health care reform, that sort of thing, it's just an impossible job. So I respect the position. But number two, when I read John Kennedy's book, Profiles in Courage, it occurred to me that we could do this on a statewide basis here in Arkansas and talk about our own politicians and how they've acted when they had a particular crisis confront them, either positively or negatively. So that was the mission, to take the last 10 governors, and they've all been men, since World War II, and talk about a particular moment of crisis in their careers and how they dealt with it.
Well, because of time constraints and because we don't want to give the whole book away on air, let's focus on three governors that you singled out as having perhaps the most difficult calls on tough issues. Let's begin with Governor Sid McMath. He was elected in the late 1940s. He was a progressive Southern governor in the age of the Dixiecrats. Kind of what was his defining moment to you?
Well, his defining moment was he had come in after World War II. He was a legitimate war hero. Having mustered out of the Marine Corps as a lieutenant colonel and having fought in the Solomon Islands. But he comes back to Hot Springs and runs for prosecuting attorney, wins, and is a reform candidate, cleaning up some of the corruption dealing with jury trials and elections. And after that, he runs for election as governor in 1948, and this is the time when the Dixiecrats have surfaced, and the Dixiecrats largely were opposed to Harry Truman and Harry Truman's, who was the president at the time, his civil rights package. So Sid McMath had to not only run for the position but take on the Dixiecrats in the sense they wanted him to join their ranks, but he wouldn't do it because he was more of a progressive on race and he was more aligned with Harry Truman and he supported Harry Truman in 1948 and Harry Truman carried the state. Strom Thurmond, who was the candidate for the Dixiecrats, did not.
Governor Orville Faubus, legendary for his decision to block the integration of Central High School. Long after he left office, he kind of worked to revise his interpretation of events. What's your take?
Well, my take was Orville Faubus was a real curiosity. He really began his political career with Sid McMath, and they were very much alike as far as having a progressive platform, what they wanted to do for the states as far as roads and health care and salaries. But I think Orville Faubus got caught up in events that he took advantage of, in a sense, because he wanted to stay in the role of governor. He wanted to be reelected to a third term. And the way to do that was to take a dramatic position on school desegregation. And what he did, his defining moment, was to call out the troops here in Arkansas to block the entrance into Central High School of the Little Rock Nine. And he did that. It surprised virtually everyone, even some of his closest advisors, and it catapulted him into international infamy, if you will.
Your book also covers Governor Winthrop Rockefeller's tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on the Capitol steps after King's assassination. It's hard for some in younger generations to really fathom how courageous that act was, but you lived through it. Tell me, how did that event affect you?
Well, this is 1968. Martin Luther King had just been assassinated. Winthrop Rockefeller wanted to do something in memory, in honor of Martin Luther King. He was the only governor throughout the country to hold or participate in a memorial service on the state capitol steps. Now, you have to consider the fact that this was damaging and would have been very, he could have forfeited his life in the sense he could have been assassinated himself, but it could have been damaging politically to him. He was running for a second term in 7 months, and Martin Luther King, as revered as he is today, was not universally revered in the state of Arkansas in 1968. So for Winthrop Rockefeller to stand on the state capitol steps and sing with several black ministers, "We Shall Overcome," and join ranks at that memorial service was a very, very courageous act.
Well, there are obviously 7 other governors profiled in this book. I know this next question would be a bit like asking you to pick your favorite child, but whose challenge and the way they dealt with that challenge do you think was the most significant in the state's history?
Well, I don't want to pick the most significant, but obviously the Orville Faubus decision was a major decision, and we're still living with that today. But I think the decisions by Dale Bumpers, as far as eliminating political corruption in the state, as far as Bill Clinton with his, it was teacher testing, and that was very controversial, but it kind of laid the groundwork for adequacy in education. Do we have adequate teachers? And it was very controversial at the time. It only happened for one particular term, but it was something that I think really benefited the state in the long run. Jim Guy Tucker salvaged the Medicaid program in a very perilous time. Mike Huckabee, I thought, was very courageous in his stand on consolidation of the schools, and this would result in some of the local school districts being merged and consolidated. What is more controversial than that? So all of these men, David Pryor on the Strawberry River, all of these men really took courageous steps in their particular terms.
Arkansas Supreme Court Justice Robert Brown is the author of the new book, Defining Moments, Historic Decisions by Arkansas Governors from McMath through Huckabee. He talked about the book with Roby Brock, a frequent Ozarks at Large contributor and the owner and publisher of the website talkbusiness.net. Support for Roby Brock's coverage of Arkansas business and politics is provided by Hendricks College, a residential undergraduate liberal arts college. Learn more at hendricks.edu/odyssey. And the Little Rock National Airport at fly-lit.com, where travelers can book air, car, and hotel reservations online, track flights, and check the weather. Mobile phone access is also available at fly-lit.com/mobile. And Bank of the Ozarks, offering the tools and services to make Arkansas businesses work. More information is available at bankozarks.com. Earlier today, the Uptown Fayetteville Association held a press conference to reveal their new logo and announce their new website. And for many, the announcement of the Uptown Fayetteville Association might be the first time they've heard of the group, which was officially formed last fall. The Uptown Fayetteville Association takes in businesses in the northern part of the city. This morning, before he went to the press conference, we reached Jeff Bishop, the general manager of Northwest Arkansas Mall and one of the board members of Uptown Fayetteville Association, in his office.
This is actually one piece of the work that the board has been engaged in since last fall when we announced the formation of the Uptown Fayetteville Association. It was about a year ago, and as I mentioned, we've been engaged for the last 12 months almost in putting the structure together, if you will, of the nonprofit corporation, gathering membership, gathering support from sponsors, and I might add the support of Mayor Jordan here in Fayetteville and also Steve Clark from the Fayetteville Chamber.
Help me out here. If I'm saying Uptown Fayetteville, what am I referring to?
Well, it's in general terms, it would be North Fayetteville. It would be basically anywhere. Our geographic boundaries per our bylaws are would be the north-south boundaries of Zion Road to Fulbright Expressway, and the east-west boundaries would be College Avenue to Gregg Avenue. And if you fall within that geographic area, you are eligible to be a full member, if you will, of Uptown Fayetteville. However, if you fall in an area that's contiguous to that, let's say maybe Millsap, Joyce Boulevard on the east side of college, you're still eligible for membership. It's just a different type of membership. And then also we've got sponsorship type memberships too that are available for folks that want to come in and partner with us as a sponsor.
Uptown Fayetteville Association will work with downtown Fayetteville, the Dixon Street area?
Absolutely. That's one of the things that we have stressed from the very beginning, is that it's not our intent to be divisive in any way at all. It's merely to tell our story, if you will. We believe that Fayetteville is unique in its offering of the tradition of the University of Arkansas, along with the culture of the Walton Arts Center, entertainment district, downtown in the square. When you throw in to the story the idea or the fact that you've got this bustling economic zone here in North Fayetteville, what we are calling Uptown Fayetteville, that offers world-class shopping, spas, salons, probably the largest stadium seating theater in the region, along with the Arkansas Music Pavilion and the Botanical Gardens, we just really believe that that makes the story of Fayetteville that much stronger, yeah.
And you have a new logo as well.
We do, and that's part of what we are holding the press conference for today, is to announce this new logo along with our new website. The logo was created by Jeanette Balzera at Scribe Marketing, and she gave us several potential logos to look at, and when we saw this one, we were all immediately on board with it.
It has one of the parts of the U is a fork, and there's a shopping bag in the middle of the P, so it's trying.
That's right. And we're showing what would be a high-rise office building, and then also I think it may be called the reader board that you would use in movie productions.
Oh, right, when you say take 45 or whatever.
Right, exactly. So there's several elements to the logo that are immediately recognizable as, you know, some of the offering that we have in Uptown Fayetteville. So it's a fantastic logo, and we're thrilled to have Jeanette on board with us. And another piece of this announcement today is also with Tim Yayak from NH Media, who has created our website for us. And so it will go live today as well. And it's got two components there. It actually shows the Uptown Fayetteville experience, if you will, as far as that offering from dining and shopping and services and entertainment. And there's also a link on that website that will take you to the Uptown Fayetteville Association page. So it's very exciting. It's a milestone for us to, you know, have come through this previous 12 months of work, and to see that really kind of all being brought out at the same time here.
Jeff Bishop is general manager of Northwest Arkansas Mall and a board member of the Uptown Fayetteville Association. The group held a press conference earlier today to announce a new logo and launch a website. The group officially formed last fall. We reached Jeff in his office this morning in advance of the press conference. This is Ozarks at Large. Local support for Ozarks at Large comes from Walton Arts Center, presenting the Chamber Orchestra Academy of St. Martin in the Fields with pianist Jonathan Biss on Friday, October 29th. Featuring an all-Mozart program, pieces will include Divertimento in D major, Symphony No. 29 in A major, and Piano Concerto No. 12 in A major. Tickets and more information available at waltonartcenter.org or 443-5600. And Serta Pro Painters, serving residential and commercial clients with interior and exterior painting needs, including interior design, deck and fence staining, and specialty finishes. Locally owned and operated by Aaron Lewis. Estimates and information available at 1-800-GO-SERTA or SertaProPainters.com. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Eureka Springs. A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF has proudly served as your source for NPR programming for the past 25 years. You can listen to us online anywhere in the world at KUAF.com. And speaking of Eureka, the Friends of the Eureka Springs Carnegie Public Library will open their fall book sale Thursday evening from 6 until 8 at the library's annex at 194 Spring Street. The sale will continue Friday from 9 until 6 and Saturday from 9 until 4. All proceeds go to the library's acquisitions fund. For more information, 253-8754. And everyone here at KUAF is preparing for our fall on-air fundraiser. It begins next week, Wednesday, October 20th, and we're hoping to make it the shortest KUAF fundraiser ever. And we believe we can do it in just 3 days. You can help us with that goal right now by sending or calling in your contribution in advance. Once we reach our goal of $140,000, the fundraiser will end. You can contribute online at KUAF.com or call 800-522-KUAF. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for tuning in. I'll be back tomorrow at noon with a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large.